This is Lee Vaughn, Veils of the Beloved and Inner Feminine, April 14th, 1990, tape 1 of 2.
Anybody hear me if I talk like that? Is that fine? So I was going to talk today about the feminine within the psyche, which is what Jung called the anima within the man, and how it functions psychologically and spiritually. This is in some ways the second half of a talk which I'm going to give next Friday, which is about the animus, about the masculine part within a woman. But hopefully it'll be interesting for both men and women to see what my perception of the anima is. The anima is in a way part of this, is very mysterious. And I'd like to begin by giving a little story from Amanda Mayama, who is a wonderful Indian saint. She never studied anything. She never read anything. I think she was illiterate, actually. And she was just filled with bliss all her life, which was quite extraordinary. And she was talking about God's game of hide and seek. And I think the anima is very much part of God's game of hide and seek. And Amanda Mayama tells the following story. A wealthy merchant once went on a business trip. A thief in the guise of a businessman joined him, intent upon robbing him at the earliest suitable occasion. Each morning, before leaving the inn in which they happened to have put up for the night, the merchant would count his money quite openly and then put it in his pocket. At night, the merchant went to sleep, seemingly without suspicion. While he was asleep, the thief would frantically search through all the belongings of the merchant without being able to find the money. After several nights of frustrating searching, the thief, finally in resignation, confessed to the merchant his true intention and pleaded with him to tell how he was able to hide his money so successfully. The merchant replied casually, "I knew from the beginning what you were up to, so every night I placed the money under your pillow. I could safely sleep knowing full well that that would be the one place where you would never look." And Amanda Mayama comments, "God is within everyone, but man goes out in search of him. This is what constitutes God's play and God's creation." And I think for a man, the whole inner feminine and what it means is a fascinating part of God's play and God's creation, this mysterious feminine quality that draws him here and draws him there and makes him dance this and makes him dance that and drives him crazy and drives him into love and despair and passion and forgetfulness, and also, in an extraordinary mysterious way, drives him to God or takes him to God or teases him to God or fascinates him to God or whatever. And it's really extraordinary, this whole, the whole business of the feminine within man's psyche. I mean, the feminine in a woman's psyche is different, so we can talk about that later. There was a lovely song in the 60s, which I'm sure you all know, by Leonard Cohen, called Suzanne, which is a most simple description of the feminine within man's psyche, of this alluring feminine. I just read you out some of the lyrics. Suzanne takes you down to her place by the river. You can hear the boats go by. Begin when you come. Takes you down to her place by the river. You can hear the boats go by. You can spend the night beside her. And you know that she's half crazy, but that's why you want to be there. And she feeds you tea and oranges that come all the way from China. And just when you mean to tell her that you have no love to give her, she gets you on her wavelength and lets the river answer that you've always been her lover. And that's the mysterious alluring, fascinating, and crazy quality of the feminine for a man. It's really very fascinating in that. I mean, he really tuned into it and captured it very, very brilliantly. I mean, of course, to me, it makes one understand why the song was so popular at that time. You know, who knew anything about Jungian psychology or animus or anima or anything? But there was this description of the feminine. And it comes out in this last line very, very poignantly. You've always been her lover. And that's the great mystery of the feminine for a man. You've always been her lover because she is the eternal woman within your psyche. She is the goddess. And somewhere you've always been in love with her. And that's, I mean, it's played out in human relationships in this sort of, you know, well-known fantasy that you meet somebody, you fall in love, and you feel you've known them forever. And of course you don't know them at all, but what you have known forever is the mysterious god or goddess on which you project upon them. And that you've always known, but because it's part of you. It's part of your own infinite self. And the masculine and feminine within the psyche, the animus and anima, they have this extraordinary quality that they're partly personal and they're partly archetypal. So they're partly your own personal feminine, but they also belong to the world of eternity. And that's why it's so fascinating and paradoxical, because often you have the two qualities playing together. You have the personal, the temporal, and the eternal, and sometimes the eternal comes in front and totally overshadows the personal, and sometimes it recedes into the background and the personal is there, and there's a person you know, and it's this, for a man, it's this fascinating veiling and unveiling. And of course for the Sufi it's even more deeply fascinating, because God is the beloved. And so in the veiling and the unveiling of the feminine, you have the veiling and the unveiling of God. And it takes you, and you know, God teases one as much as a woman teases one. And God takes you and then drops you, seemingly, and takes you and then drops you and then comes back. And it's this strange, strange dance that is played out on the human scale and on the divine scale. And the Sufi always says human relationships are learning about the great relationship, just as a girl plays with dolls in order to learn to become a mother. So we, through our human relationships, learn about the one great relationship. Because all human love is ultimately an illusion. And there is only the real relationship. Everything is a mirror of that. And so this is the fascinating quality of the feminine. It takes you, it lures you, and draws you deeper and deeper and deeper into yourself eventually. But you have to find it often by falling in love, by projecting it on somebody else. And then this ordinary woman becomes a goddess. And, you know, I've often, because I've only known it from the side of one who projects it, I often wonder what it's like for a woman to have, you know, to suddenly become a goddess. I mean, you know, you know, did your mother tell you what to do about it? You know. I mean, it must be both sort of wonderful and incredibly annoying, I imagine. Both sort of, you know, because where you come in, I don't know. I mean, I don't know if the woman can respond with the eternal part of herself. I mean, in the ancient days, this was of course part of the role of the priestess in the temples, and they were instructed how to evoke that out of a man, both sexually and psychologically. And they knew how to do it. They knew how to... It's like the ancient temple dances were the dance of the eternal feminine. And they knew in their music and their dance how to evoke this archetype within a man's psyche. And this is Venus coming out on the shell out of the ocean, you know, coming out of the depths of the unconscious. Beautiful beyond belief. And I mean, occasionally I've seen it in myself, one projects, to project it on somebody, and then to take, see that projection fall off, and to see this extraordinary thing where somebody suddenly becomes incredibly beautiful, maybe only for half an hour, half a day, half a year. And then it falls off and you see just an ordinary person with a slightly spotty face or whatever, you know, or a turned up nose, or it doesn't matter. And then you see this projection come back from the depths of the unconscious. It comes and it puts itself on this person, and sometimes, and then they become so extraordinarily beautiful. That person for you is the most beautiful person in the world. And it has nothing to do with logic, and it has nothing to do with the mind. In the West it really began, this whole thing of romantic love and courtly love and the whole, everything that came with it, and the adoration of the woman, which was combined with the rejection of the woman in a strange sort of psychological process that went on. So she is both a goddess and also a siren. And for the man, the feminine will take him to heaven and drown him in the depths of the ocean. This is the siren who, you know, lured the sailors to their deaths. She sings this song and takes you, and if you're not careful, can just leave you there. And there are people who've been destroyed by it. You know, we have this sort of, you know, feminine on the positive side. She is Ariadne. She is this figure who takes you out of the maze, or allows you to go into the very depths of your unconscious and confront the Minotaur, the monster that is there, and then is the thread that allows you to come back. And it's very interesting because Jung, you know, he was quite happily married, but when he went into the depths of his unconscious, he had to have this relationship with Toni Wolff, because his wife wasn't his anima figure. And so, you know, I mean, his wife must have been extraordinary, because it was a small, puritanical Swiss town, and he very openly had an affair with Toni Wolff. And he said he needed this anima figure in order to explore his unconscious. He needed this relationship with this woman who, for him, and she's not attractive at all, just like Cleopatra wasn't attractive. It's nothing to do with that. It's not to do with external beauty at all. It's, you know, some women have this quality of being able to evoke and play on this aspect in a man's psyche. You know, and it's very, very fascinating. Somebody had a dream which described this very beautifully, in which it was a very simple dream. He just saw a woman in a slinky blue dress singing in a soulful way, walking back to happiness. And being a very slinky soulful singer, because of course the feminine is the music of the soul. It's the music of the deepest inner being for a man. It's quite, you know, and of course it's so beyond the mind, and it's so beyond the thoughts. And I think particularly in the West, where we're not brought up to know what it is. And unfortunately it gets labeled with romantic love without much understanding of the real depth and the real meaning of romantic love. And the fact that it brings you happiness and it brings you despair. But she takes you back to happiness, walking back to happiness, because the journey to the feminine is a journey back, is a journey back into the depths of oneself. She is a thread that... And of course, because women have a much deeper or more instinctual understanding of the inner world than the man. A man lives in the conscious world in a way that a woman doesn't. And one can talk forever about the difference between masculine and feminine psychology, but I'm always amazed that women have an instinctual understanding of how the inner world functions. It's like they feel all the threads that go on, the interrelationship of everything, because in the unconscious, in the inner world, everything is interrelated. Everything flows in and out of everything else. Everything is one there, and a woman... You know, it's like a woman will know what her child feels and why her child feels it when the child can't say anything, in a way that a man never will. Because a woman has this oneness. A woman somewhere never leaves the oneness of the Great Mother. And it's beautifully exhibited in primitive societies at adolescence, at puberty. the men have to leave the woman's hut, and they have all the initiations of puberty, and which are often very painful. And then they leave and they go into the man's hut or the boy's hut, and they're never allowed back into the mother's hut, into the women's hut. Now, a girl doesn't do that. A girl never leaves the mother's hut until she comes to get married. And this has immense psychological meaning, because a woman never leaves that world of oneness, that world of the Great Mother. The consciousness of the feminine always remains within the realm of the Great Mother. So for a man, this is quite extraordinary, because a woman is in tune with that. It's like, you know, in a way that for a woman, the most simplest things, the most natural things, I found, are often what is most distant and most extraordinary for a man. They live in this interrelated, this harmony. And so they can take and guide a man, both the inner feminine and also the projection of that onto a woman, if a woman allows herself to carry the projection. And it used to be in the chivalric days, it was the man would go off to war, and he would take his lady's pennant with him. And what he would actually do, he would leave his soul in safekeeping with the woman. And this is something that I don't think is very much understood, that there is in the anima relationship, in the male-female relationship, there is a quality in which the man will give his soul into the safekeeping of the woman. And it actually happens very often, particularly men who live very, very consciously and have very little relationship with their unconscious, but often form very deep attachments with a woman, then the woman will carry the soul of the man, because somehow she has an understanding of the way the inner world works in a way that a man doesn't at all. And so through this relationship, through this mysterious inner feminine figure, a man can walk back to happiness, which is, because happiness is in the source. True happiness, joy. There's a lovely line from this extraordinary book called Talking with Angels. I don't know if some of you know it, about this woman, Dieter Mahler, who, just before the Second World War, and she had some Jewish friends, and they were about to be taken into concentration camp. And they had this extraordinary relationship with angels. And the angels, they recorded these conversations they had with the angels. And a lot of it's very, very extraordinary. And two lines that the angel said is, when motion returns to the source, joy is born in the human. When motion returns to the source, joy is born in the human. Joy, and it's something I found in working in the unconscious, joy belongs to the source. True happiness, and happiness is like an aspect of joy. Joy is the deep. Blake wrote in one of his poems, infant joy, you know. I have no name, I am but 2 days old. Sweet joy is my name, sweet joy befall thee. Joy comes from the source. The true joy, and joy is like the stream of life bubbling up. If you go into the unconscious, it's actually there. There's the point in which the source of life, the river of life, bubbles out like a spring, and that's where joy is. The deep, deep joy of our own being that is our birthright. And it's nothing to do with external things fulfilling one in that sense, or external stimulation. It's the joy of life, like you sometimes see in very young children before they've been cut off from the source. And the feminine can help a man go back to that source, to that joy that is one's own self, that is the stream of one's own life coming out of the rock of the self, if you like. That bubbling up that, you know, one feels it sometimes. There are some, you know, one wakes up on a particular morning and it's there. Or one turns a corner in a street and suddenly it's there. Or it suddenly comes, this joy that comes from deep, deep inside. Or something happens in one's outer circumstance that gives it a space, that takes one back to that thing. And I think for a man this is one of the qualities of the feminine that allows him to walk back to that happiness that is life, that is life expressing itself, that is the joy of creativity. You sometimes feel it if you're an artist and you tune into this creativity, and sometimes creativity is pain and suffering, but sometimes there is also joy, there is also this essence, joy, which is the essence of life. And she is also, the inner feminine is also the Virgin Mary, this extraordinary purity of the feminine which is within oneself. Guruji always said a woman is always pure. A woman can never not be pure. She is like gold in the earth. Just like the earth itself is not actually dirty, the earth can never be dirty. The earth can be polluted with our conscious selves, but the earth itself is never dirty. It's earth. And the woman is always pure. So the inner feminine is that purity out of which is born the Christ child, the self, the archetype of wholeness, whatever you call it, Brahma. And so for a man to give birth to the self, to his own immortalness, his own divinity, he needs the feminine, he needs what the alchemists called the sacred marriage, the conjunctio. A woman in a different way needs the relationship of the animus, of her masculine self. But a man needs this sacred feminine. And I think there will be a much deeper understanding of the whole relationship of man and women once, in a way that it can be understood that a woman can carry that for a man, can allow him to experience that. It doesn't mean she always has to carry his projections. It isn't to do with that. It's allowing the divinity within herself to echo the divinity of his own feminine self. Allowing the goddess within herself to respond to his need, to echo. And then there can become a sacred marriage can be allowed to be enacted, which is always on the soul level. And it's not to do with the ego, and it's not to do with personality at all. It's allowing the, if you like, archetype to speak to archetype. And eventually out of that is, from the Virgin Mary, from the pure feminine. And the virgin means pure. It does nothing to do with sexuality. It's to do with being true to oneself, being true to one's own divinity, to one's own archetypal nature. And out of that is born one's eternal nature. Because everything on the physical plane mirrors the inner plane. And just as the outer child, which is always a symbol of the self, the outer baby is born from the union of masculine and feminine, so it must be within the psyche. So we need the masculine and feminine within the psyche to give birth to ourselves. This is the child which is one's own deepest nature. But the feminine, the inner feminine, also has a very, very destructive side. She can be absolutely brutal and she can destroy a man. This is most succinctly imaged. I mean, this, she is the siren that just takes him into the depths and leaves him there. There was this film called The Blue Angel with Marlene Dietrich. I don't know if some of you have seen it, in which the central song is Falling in Love Again, Never Wanted To. And what Marlene Dietrich, she is, that you don't know, she is a circus actress. And this very, very eminent professor falls in love with her. And she allows him to fall in love with her. And he leaves his job as a respectable professor in this small German town and he joins a circus. And she slowly and ruthlessly degrades him until he becomes a clown. And then the final thing she does is they go back to this town in which he was once a respected professor. And she makes him perform as a clown in front of his previous pupils and everything. She totally ruins him and degrades him. And then eventually he goes back to the classroom in which he used to teach and he hangs himself. And this is, one has to accept this is an aspect of the feminine. There is the English poet Keats, who had understood that very much, whether he understood it consciously, I don't know. He wrote a very beautiful poem called La Belle Dame sans Merci. And I remember reading this to somebody who had had an anima figure who was like that, who'd almost destroyed him, and it really shook him. La Belle Dame sans Merci. Oh, what can ail thee, knight at arms, alone and palely loitering? The sedge has withered from the lake, and no birds sing. Oh, what can ail thee, knight at arms, so haggard and so woebegone? The squirrel's granary is full, and the harvest's done. I see a lily on thy brow, with anguish moist and fever dew, and on thy cheeks a fading rose, fast withered too. I met a lady in the meads, full beautiful, a fairy's child. Her hair was long, her foot was light, and her eyes were wild. I made a garland for her head, and bracelets too, and fragrant zone. She looked at me as she did love, and made sweet moan. I set her on my pacing steed, and nothing else saw all day long, for sidelong would she bend and sing a fairy's song. She found me roots of wet relish sweet, and honey wild and manna dew, and sure in language strange she said, I love thee true. She took me to her elfin grot, and there she wept and sighed full sore, and there I shut her wild, wild eyes with kisses for. And there she lulled me asleep, and there I dreamt, oh woe betide, the latest dream I ever dreamt on the cold hillside. I saw pale kings and princes too, pale warriors, death pale they were they all. They cried, La belle dame sans merci hath thee in thrall. I saw their starved lips in the gloam, with horrid warning gaped wide, and I awoke and found me here on the cold hillside. And this is why I sojourn here, alone and palely loitering, for the sedge hath withered from the lake, and no bird sing. And that's the mysterious feminine who lures a man asleep into the unconscious and leaves him there, and he can never get out, and destroys him. And there are women who know how to use a man, who know to get exactly what they want from a man, because they understand the workings of the unconscious in a way that a man does not. A woman, you can call it manipulation, I don't know how you like to see it, but there is, you understand how to play that music, how to lull a man asleep, and that's the siren's call, and this is the whole extraordinary dynamic. What actually stops the man being taken over by the anima? And Jung himself had a lot of conversations with the anima. His anima wanted him to be an artist and to stop his scientific pursuits. He said, she said, you're a very great, you could become a wonderful artist. But he knew that if he succumbed to this fantasy of the anima, then he would be lost forever. He would never he would never make his work so it would be accessible to other people, just be an artist. And this is of course mirrored, because what is the greatest anima figure is Maya, the goddess of creation. What an illusion she weaves for us. She isn't. The dance of creation is the ultimate dance, the dance of Maya. And this is what in the Lord's Prayer, when it says, lead me not into temptation. Such temptation, the feminine side of God, his creation, is extraordinary. And this is the whole polarity, is that the creation, the world, can either be a path home, or it can be a fantasy, you live in it forever. And the difference here is consciousness. And it's in both the inner world and the outer world. If you are conscious, then you can never be swamped by the unconscious. If you are conscious of the part you play in the world, and conscious means to step back and look, then you will see behind the dance of Maya. Of course, one is so often totally entranced and carried away, and you lose yourself. And what does it mean to lose yourself? You lose the consciousness. It's what the Sufis call witnessing. To witness, to watch. Just to watch. And this is why one should always watch oneself very carefully. Mrs. Tweedy says one should be like a cat in front of a mouse hole, infinitely relaxed, infinitely patient, but infinitely alert all the time. And if you have that consciousness in your life, you don't do anything, you just watch. You watch your reactions to circumstance, you watch what attracts you in life, what repels you in life, you just watch. The very quality of you watching changes the dynamic. It means you can never be swamped by the unconscious. And it means you can also never get lost in life, because some way, if you watch, you then begin to see the pattern. And life is an extraordinary, incredibly intricate pattern, like those Islamic patterns. Actually, the ancient Islamic patterns are pictures of the patterns of creation, the underlying dynamic of creation. And if you watch it carefully, then you begin to see this interrelationship, the interflow of masculine and feminine. And you begin to see your part that you play in it. And once you consciously play your part, and again, consciously is not that you know what you're doing, because you never know what you're doing. It's very difficult. It's a paradox. You know, it's like the famous saying, one is just like a pen in the hands of God. And how does the pen ever know the words that it is writing? But in order to be a pen, you have to be conscious. You have to witness. You have to watch. And your very consciousness allows God to become conscious of himself. Through your consciousness, he sees himself. If you like, the whole of creation then goes up an octave. This was the experience Jung had when he was in Africa, and he was on top of a hill in the Serengeti, and he saw these extraordinary animals all underneath him. You know, hundreds of miles and all these animals, and he was aware that if he wasn't there watching it, nobody would ever see it. But the very aspect of him watching it allowed it to be seen. And this is the extraordinary, the highest, is why human beings are the highest aspect of creation. It's why they are the pinnacle of creation, because they can see it. And through them seeing it, he can see it. And this is what Thiers de Chardin, when he said God evolves through man, and he was almost excommunicated for it. Because through our consciousness and our becoming more conscious, then God evolves. And then you play your part in the unfolding pattern of creation once you have that consciousness. And that's what he gets. You know, one can use one's consciousness for the ego and not look and not step back and just go out and get what you want and use that energy for those purposes. Or you can watch. And this is, of course, in the whole Buddhist thing of what is learning to be detached means. Of not being caught up in the whole wheel of life. The moment you step back and you watch. But there's also, it actually has another deeper purpose. The moment you step back and you watch, then an extraordinary process of transformation happens. And almost if you just do that, if you just watch yourself all the time, that is a spiritual practice that can take you home. We once had somebody came to our group and he had this amazing dream. His Sufi practice was what's just called witnessing. That was his meditation, that's all he did. He just witnessed, he just watched. And he had this extraordinary dream that he was giving birth himself. And the child was encapsulated in fire. And there was a woman there who was a bit worried about the fire. But the child itself was not worried about the fire. The child was perfectly happy with the fire. And that's, of course, an image of giving birth to one's own spiritual self, which one gives birth to out of oneself. One gives birth to oneself out of oneself. It's like this lovely line, "It takes time to make a soul pregnant with God," that Guruji said to Tweedy. And spiritual life is a pregnancy. Somebody puts a spark in your heart. He puts a spark in your heart and blows on it. And if you tend it, then that's the fire that gives birth to itself. It's like the phoenix. It consumes you, and in consuming you, it then regenerates. It then becomes reborn. And just through watching, just through witnessing, you allow it to happen. It's terribly simple. You watch yourself, you watch your reactions, and I say you watch your dreams, you just look at them. And that very dynamic transforms you. You go on one level, you don't have to do anything else, you just have to watch. And of course in relationship to the feminine, this is imaged in the myth of Perseus and his shield. The feminine, the negative side of the feminine is the Gorgon's head, full of serpents. that turns you to stone. And what does being turned to stone means? Being to petrify. The unconscious is very powerful. It can destroy you. It can petrify you. It can make it so you can't move. And you get people who are so caught up by the unconscious that they can't move. This is like the spider who eats her young. And you get this devouring mother, and you get people who are so devoured by them that they can't do anything in life. They can't move. They've become petrified. They've become turned to stone. And this is actually imaged in many fairy tales. If you know The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, what the witch turns the animals to stone. Those who go into her power, they all become stone. And this is the quality of, the negative quality of the feminine, of the unconscious. It swamps you. It turns you to stone. You can't move. You can't do anything. You're caught in the grips of your unconscious, and then you develop phobias, and you're caught by your phobias, and you develop complexes, and you're caught by your complexes. And you develop allergies, and you're caught by your allergies. And it goes on, and you have to see this therapist, and that healer, and this acupuncturist, and you go round and round forever. What it actually means is you are held by the unconscious. And it can play such tricks on you, because it knows you, because it is you. You know, it knows your weaknesses, and it leads you down the garden path, and then you think, you know, and what's more, you know, you feel it's all right, and you know, this is as it should be, and then suddenly, you know, gosh, you wake up one day and you thought, what a fool I've been. I've been totally conned, you know, and it wasn't like that at all. You weren't really ill at all. It was all your unconscious stopping you from going on to the next step. And I mean, it's happened to me, and I'm sure it's happened to a lot of people. It will. And what's more, it's so convincing, you know. Because, of course, it's you convincing yourself. And if anybody knows how to convince yourself, you know how to convince yourself. And it takes you for. And, of course, if you're on a spiritual path, it gives spiritual reasons. And then it has a field day, because you don't really know what it's talking about at all. And then you say, or it's just, they're all spiritual systems and you can't go off and do anything because you're in such a spiritual state and you can't possibly go out and have a job because it's, you know, you're going through this spiritual experience and you have a spiritual emergency and, you know, and you can play that game forever. And apparently in California, people can make a lot of money out of it too, you know. And you know, you even think you're evolving, which is, of course, you know, the ultimate myth and the ultimate con trick. And all it is, you know, the great mother's got her grips on you, and you're not allowed to do anything. And if you have a teacher, what she actually does, in my experience, Miss Vidi, is she lets you do it. She doesn't say anything at all. Occasionally she'll drop a hint, but you won't hear it because you'll be so caught up in your own things. And she'll tell a story, but you think, oh, it's not about me. And she'll speak to somebody else, and it'll sort of wrinkle a bit, but then you dismiss it because you know what you're doing, and you're having these experiences, and that's what's important to you. And then, you suddenly get hit on the head so hard, and you suddenly realize what an absolute idiot you've been. And you look back, and you see how that hint to that time, she knew exactly what was happening, she knew exactly what you were doing. You see, because this wonderful thing, if somebody tells you something, and even if you do what they say, you don't learn because you're just following somebody's instructions. You know, but if you fall into the mud yourself and you get all covered with it, and if, you know, particularly the wonderful thing is if you make a fool of yourself in front of a group, you know, that's absolutely, you know, then that's absolutely, and it happens to everybody in our group, you know, they, you know, you've absolutely got, you know, and of course, you know, she will often then talk about it afterwards or, you know, quite openly in front of 40 people, and you will become about that big and wish you'd never been born. And it's perfect. It's really, you know, it's, and she just, you know, after she just lets you do it. And it's so. And then you think, I'm never going to do it again. I'm never going to make the same mistake again. I've learned my lesson this time. And 6 months later, you do it again. Hopefully in a slightly smaller way. No, it's wonderful. But that's how it's supposed to be, because I think you can only learn if you sit in the mud and fall in the mud and And it's that, to me, it's the best way of getting rid of the ego. You know, God, if you, you make mistakes and then it really rubs you off, and especially if they're made in public, and then it really rubs you off. Yeah. I mean, there was an ancient Sufi sect in Nishapur who were called the Blameworthy, and they actually did it on purpose. They went around and got everybody to make them blamed, to blame them for things. And that was their spiritual practice, that they were the Blameworthy, and they decided that's the way to get rid of the ego, to attract all the blame. I think it's a bit delicate if you try and do it, because then who's the... Anyway, you make enough mess yourself. Anyway. But the wonderful thing is it's all, in the end, created. You know, it's, you know, your shadow plays these incredible tricks on you and leads you into all sorts of messes. But that's what being, you know, that's what being rubbed down is about. And if you use it creatively, then in my experience anyway, it's wonderful. And it always comes just at the right moment whenever you've got a little bit inflated. Then it's like when Guruji said this thing to Mrs. Tweedy, and just in the middle of a conversation with somebody, he turned to her and said, "Why don't you become a human being?" And it really astounded her. And that was, and then she realized afterwards that she'd become really inflated. And all one has to, you see, all one has to do on a spiritual path is to become a human being. And it's, you know, one thinks one should become this and should be that and should definitely be a spiritual person. And in fact, all you have to do is just be a human being. Just live your life as it comes to you, you know, as best you can each day. That's all that matters. And to live it consciously, just to be aware. I mean, as aware as one can be, because what is the shadow? The shadow is lack of awareness. The shadow is the unconscious coming and you getting caught up in it. And, you know, and the only thing is after a while you get to know your shadow a bit and you, it doesn't lead you down the garden path quite so long, because you get to know the symptoms, you get to know how it operates. And hopefully. And then you discover, of course, parts of you didn't know, and you realize awful long garden paths you've been led down again and again and again without even realizing it. But slowly this consciousness comes, and this is what's... I mean, in the myth of Perseus, this is his shield. He can defeat the Gorgon, the devouring mother, the dark side of the feminine, through consciousness, through reflection. Reflection is consciousness. The moment you reflect upon something, you are being conscious about it. If you don't reflect, you are driven, often by unconscious drives, by unconscious patterns, you just get driven. But the moment you reflect on something, you're conscious. And the power of the negative feminine is it actually stops you having any creative relationship with the unconscious. It stops you working creatively, because to work with the unconscious is a creative relationship. And if you're dominated by dominated by the negative feminine, the negative mother, you know, and so many people in our group have spider dreams. Remember the spider, you know, the spider is the ultimate symbol of the devouring mother, because a spider eats her young. And so many people have that in their psyche, this negative feminine that just devours them, it doesn't allow them to do anything. In fact, I mean, somebody I know who had a real problem with the feminine. He even was taken to a marriage party, and he was told, "There is no space for you here." And he wanted to take part in this party, but he was told, "You're not allowed to sit here." And then he was given, in the dream, an effigy of a female figure, and underneath this effigy, I think of a female figure, was, "She can put out any fire." That's what was written underneath. She can put out any fire, any passion, any relationship, anything creative you might want to do, this negative aspect of feminine will put out. She won't allow you to do anything. I mean, of course, which is actually totally true, somebody who finds it very difficult to have a relationship with women, very difficult to do somewhere in life what he wants to do. And it's, you know, but the beauty, of course, is the moment it comes up from the unconscious in a dream, it becomes conscious. The moment he saw symbolically, in this symbolic effigy, the moment it was symbolized, it meant it actually had had come together, this particular psychological problem that was making his life havoc, mess, meant he couldn't do anything. It had formed into the unconscious. It had become a symbol. It had become conscious. It was now telling him what the problem is. And in doing that, in the very act of it becoming conscious, it was able to be transformed. And what I find extraordinary, he didn't know what to do about this dream. He didn't know, you know, he had this dream. This was the ultimate problem in his life was being portrayed to him. And he had no idea what to do about it. What on earth do you do? You know, you're shown. This is an aspect of your unconscious. She can do whatever she likes. She can put out any fire. But then, about 2 months later, he had a dream in which he was with somebody who had been very, very ill, almost fatally ill, but was now getting better. And in his hand, he had a piece of the moon. And he knew in his hand that this rock of the moon was the real stuff. The feminine, the rock of the feminine, the basic part of the feminine, the essence of the feminine, come from the moon, it had come to him. He had it in his hand. And this problem that he had that seemed almost fatal was going to get better. And he didn't have to do anything except watch, except look at his problem and become conscious of it. Of course, it's very, very difficult, because if you have those sort of problems, nobody likes to think they've got those sort of problems, and to really consciously look at it requires immense effort, because the whole dynamic of that is to stop you looking at it, is to make you unconscious, is to run away from it. And that's what the effort is just to hold it. And of course, what I find where psychology, and I think Sufism goes one step further than most psychology, is Sufism says, well, you look at it, but you look at it in your heart. You love it. And that puts an extraordinary dynamic into it that changes it much more quickly. You hold it in your heart. You hold the problem in your heart. You love the problem. Instead of having this witch and trying to get rid of her, you love her. It's like Sufis are not allowed to protect themselves. A friend of ours from the group went to a psychic and she said, "How? You know, you're not protecting yourself, you're not looking after yourself, you're all open," and she couldn't understand it, and it really blew her, because she saw it, you know, being psychic, she saw a bit, that this person was totally open. And she said, "How come? You know, you don't close yourself down and protect yourself and put rings of fire around yourself and all of that." And the person came to Miss Tweedy and said, she said, "But we Sufis don't work like that. We protect ourselves by giving out love. We exterminate our enemies through loving them." Because love is the most powerful force in the universe. And if you give out love, nothing can harm you. And if they do harm you, it's his will anyway, so what? So that's why, you know, that's why it's so dynamic. And as much as you do it externally, you do it internally. And, you know, it's like if you get an angry person in your dream coming to you and shouting at you, you know, you just love them, and that transforms them, because everything inside you just wants to be loved. You know, it's like the screaming adolescent children or whatever it is. They just want to be loved. They just want a little bit of place in the sun. They just want a little place in your heart. And the secret extraordinary magic is if you put them in your heart. You just have to put them in your heart and wrap them in love and look after them. And if you like, speak to them, or just wrap them in cotton wool in your heart. Give them a kiss. And then they change. And this anger and this violence and the aggression and the mother that eats you up slowly changes. Okay, it may take years, may take 10 years, but so what? It changes you. It changes altogether. And then all that energy that had been destructive. And this is what was very, very interesting, is last year, Michael and myself, we went down to this Jungian conference in Georgia, and Robert Johnson was there, you know, who wrote He and She and We, and he's somebody I admire immensely, and he has this extraordinary capacity to evoke love in people. Everybody wants to go and just give him a hug afterwards, and it's very remarkable. He's a lovely man, but he was talking about the feminine. He was talking about the whole danger of projecting the anima and animus in a relationship, and he was saying you should never do it. You know, you get 2 days of heaven and you get 10 years of hell as a result. You know, he says, you know, you enter into this relationship because you projected a goddess on an ordinary person, and you pay for it with your, you know, he said, you should never do it in India. They have it much more sensibly. You project it onto the gods and the goddesses in the temple, and you don't, you know, you have an arranged marriage, and you don't, romantic love is not, does not form a part of your life, their life there. And he says, it's much more sensible. And it avoids an enormous amount of problems. And, you know, okay, on one level he's true, and I think the lack of understanding of in human relationships here, and you know, combined with the fact that I think people have, you know, 100 years ago, men and women, even if they were married, they didn't spend any time together hardly. I mean, if you think of in England, the, you know, the men went to the pub in the evening, the women stayed at home and looked after the kids. And the men went to, you even have in America this, we're talking about fraternities and sororities, you know, they even, everybody's separate. And in the last 30 years, you know, for some reason, which I don't think anybody, I haven't really understood, men and women suddenly have to be together a lot more. You know, they don't, they, I mean, Cecil Collins, this English artist, he said he couldn't understand, men and women are so different, he couldn't understand how they got on together at all. And, you know, I think an awful lot of problems come up because of this, and a lot of marriages don't work because we don't actually have, we've not yet got used to actually living together individually as men and women, socially or anything, and it's very, very difficult. Men and women are incredibly different. They don't talk the same language, they don't have... But that's right, Robert Johnson was saying, so you shouldn't, you know, whatever you do, you know, don't marry anybody you fall in love with, and definitely don't fall in love with anybody. you know. Or if you do, keep it to the one day and then go off somewhere else afterwards. You know. It's sort of psychological promiscuous society. And so both Michael and me, who have you know, had very strong anima relationships, or still do, were, and believe definitely in romantic love and everything that goes with it, were a bit dissatisfied by this. And we didn't agree with this at all. So we went to see Dr. Engel, who's this wonderful 88-year-old, I think he is now, Jungian therapist in New York who knew Jung. And he's a wonderful man. He's what Tweedy calls a manner personality. The moment you enter his presence, you just sort of, you feel wonderful. He has this quality, and he's a very, very, very humble, very old man who still works full-time in New York. He can't travel very much anymore. And we presented him this problem. We said, look, you know, what do you think about this? And he just came out with two words, which was unconditional love. And he says, unconditional love will transform an animus-anima projection into a soul relationship. And that's all you need. And unconditional love means you just accept, I mean, just, I mean, gosh. You know. You know, it means you just accept the other person totally as they are and love them totally as they are. And it's, of course, incredibly hard work and takes an enormous amount of time, which I don't think anybody ever told you. An enormous amount of effort. But to me, it's the only thing that makes sense of this. You know, why on earth were we given this whole thing of romantic love? You know, is it just a joke of the gods? You know, it's not just for procreation, because they've managed quite happily without it. And, you know, I think it is, as far as I understand, it is quite a recent, you know, it hasn't always existed, romantic love. People haven't always fallen in love with each other. I mean, if you have a culture that has an arranged marriage, it's not part of the culture. And, you know, it seemed in the Western world to have been born in the Middle Ages, the idea of romantic love. I'm not 100% sure about this, but so it makes sense of romantic love is that, you know, you fall in love with this god or goddess, and then you use unconditional love to work through it, to transform it, to integrate it, to get in contact with the feminine and to go with it, and to cope with the fact that, in fact, there's also a human being as well as a goddess there, or a god. And And, you know, and sometimes the relationship doesn't work, and it's not supposed to work, and you have to stop the relationship because, you know, and you get a dream or something that tells you. But more often than not, it can be a... It's what the alchemists call the prima materia, that you have... The alchemists, you know, they thought they were working with chemicals, but in fact they were working with the contents of their own unconscious because they knew nothing about chemicals. Now, I think the situation the same is true nowadays about personal relationships. We almost know nothing about personal relationships. And so into the personal relationships we project all of our unconscious. And so for us, you know, religions have gone, God's gone, everything's gone as it used to be. The old structures are gone and we're just left with each other. And you know, because we have a sort of a slightly more leisured society than when people used to work, you know, 18 hours a day, we have time to be together and we seem to be stuck together. You know, there is the prima materia, that is what we work with. That is how we get to know ourselves and our unconscious, through projecting it into our relationships or our friends or whatever. And to me that makes, you know, a lot of sense of, you know, then why men and women are suddenly having to be together. Because obviously there's an enormous opportunity for getting to know our own unconscious, our own masculine and feminine self. And, you know, unconditional love is the transforming agent. And then what you find is extraordinary. I'll tell you a dream I had, actually, because... and then we have a little break for a while. So I've always had an idealized image of the feminine, and found the dark and terrible side of the feminine slightly more difficult to come to terms with. And this has caused me some problems over the years. It may also be a collective problem, I don't know. And of course, the dark and terrible side of the feminine is known as the tiger. The tiger is the vehicle of the goddess. That is the power, the primal power and energy. In the East, the goddess rides upon a tiger. She doesn't have a horse or anything, nothing so serene or comfortable. She has a tiger. And Blake described that aspect of the feminine quite nicely, those of you who know. Tiger, tiger, burning bright in the forests of the night, what immortal hand or eye could frame thy fearful symmetry? In what distant deeps or skies burnt the fire of thine eyes? On what wings dare he aspire, what the hand dare seize the fire? And what shoulder and what art could twist the sinews of thy heart? And when thy heart began to beat, what dread hand and what dread feet? What the hammer, what the chain, in what furnace was thy brain? What the anvil, what dread grasp dare its deadly terrors clasp? When the stars threw down their spears and watered heaven with their tears, did he smile his work to see? Did he who made the lamb make thee? Tiger, tiger, burning bright in the forests of the night, what immortal hand or eye dare frame thy fearful symmetry? So she's quite a lady, this tiger. And I think she's probably, and maybe she's as terrifying to women as she is to men, I don't know. I know one friend of mine, you know, had a dream in which she saw this tiger, which was her own power, her own energy, and she found it a bit frightening. But the dream I had, which was very, very interesting, was that I'd been left in charge of a house. And what's of course interesting is that I had this dream while I was preparing this talk. Because if you go into something and then it brings up all the problems you have about it, and then it activates that. And I'd been left in charge of this house by somebody who'd gone off the night, and I was basically babysitting this house. And in this house there was, I suppose, an idealized couple, you know, romantic couple, whatever. And while I was looking after this house, a fire started in the house. And when I went into the house to rescue the couple, this idealized couple, I found that in the house there were three tigers. And they were terrified because of the fire. You know what animals are like when there's fire in the jungle. And I was terrified of the tigers. And also I didn't know what to do with the tigers. So I did a terrible thing. I got the idealized couple out. I rescued them. And then I shut the door of the house, leaving the tigers inside this burning house. And then the man who owned the house came back. And he wasn't at all worried about the fire. He just rang up the fire brigade, got through right away, and they would come and put it out. He didn't seem disturbed about the fire. And because he was there and they were his tigers, I opened the door and out came these tigers. And in a dream, I've never felt these tigers were so burnt and so much suffering in them. And they made a noise. Imagine a tiger that has been in a fire, that has been hurt so badly. And they made this sort of whimpering. These great big tigers, these three great big tigers came out. And they made this sort of whimpering noise. It was just so painful to hear and to feel it. And the two tigers got taken away to hospital, and the third tiger I sort of looked after myself, and because the owner of the house was there, I didn't feel frightened. I couldn't feel frightened of these tigers anymore anyway, because you'd seen the suffering they were in. You'd seen the pain. These great, you know, tigers are enormous. They're really big, and the pain and the suffering of these tigers. And that was that dream. And what I actually found extraordinary about the dream is, I mean, it showed, because four is the number of wholeness in the psyche, and there was the one which was the idealized, plus the three tigers which was the unconscious, the other side, the primal, the powerful, the frightening, the destructive, that aspect of the feminine, which didn't fit into my idealized picture of a woman, and I think that's probably a common problem I had. You know, because we're not taught about that very much. You know, we're not initiated into it very much. We're not told about it very much. That the power, of course, why? Because it's over the last 2,000 years, men have repressed that aspect of the feminine. You know, because quite rightly, in some ways, because they were terrified of it too. And also, in fact, women have also repressed it because it doesn't fit into society, and they don't know what to do with it either. And so, this tiger has grown in strength in the unconscious. But in the dream, what I found extraordinary is that looking back, obviously the person whose house it was, which is, if you like, my higher self, had known there would be a fire that night, and he'd gone away, and he'd asked me to look after it. Because then when he came back, he wasn't, looking back, I thought it strange, he wasn't worried by the fire, he wasn't surprised by the fire, he knew exactly what to do about the fire. But he'd gone off for the evening, and he'd left me. And what is fire? Fire means conflict. And in a way, he'd allowed this conflict to develop inside of me, because that was the only way I was going to be aware of the tigers. Only by them being hurt, only by the pain that I was inflicted, the pain that was inflicted upon these tigers, was I ever going to be aware of them? Which I find quite extraordinary. And it was actually as if the whole thing was, somewhere in the unconscious, the whole situation had been planned, this whole conflict that was happening inside of me, so I could get to know these tigers. And you know the way synchronicity works? You know, synchronicity is if something very important happens in your unconscious, it gets mirrored in the external world. And the next day, my son Emmanuel was watching a rather bad film on television in the afternoon. It was all about an African boy whose pet was a tiger who came to live in America, and how he brought the tiger to America and how he integrated the tiger in living in America. that's right. In active imagination, you know, because I was so disturbed by this dream and this tiger I was left with, and I asked it in active imagination, I just said, why? Why did it happen? Why did it happen like this? And the tiger said, it had to be that way, as if this conflict was the only way I was going to become conscious of the tiger, of that power of the feminine within myself. And then a month or so later, I had a dream that to me was sort of the reconciliation of that, in which I was with Mrs. Tweedy beside a clump of tiger lilies, And the tiger lilies had to be cut down. And I cut them with a bush knife. And then I woke up and then I went to sleep. And then in the next dream, I'd woven a meditation mat from these lilies. And I'd shown a diagram which describes how the energies of the lilies is integrated. Now that's quite extraordinary because, I mean, the unconscious is of course magic, and it has this extraordinary computer library of symbols to draw on at any particular moment. And the lily is the other side of the feminine. The lily is the Virgin Mary, is the pure side of the feminine. And in picking up this plant of a tiger lily, it had brought the two together. And then you have this thing that it had to be cut down. And it had to be cut down with a bush knife, which is something quite primitive. And this is a very extraordinary part, which I don't yet fully understand of the inner work, is what the alchemists call the opus contra naturam. That part of inner transformation is going against nature. Opus contra naturam, it goes against nature. That you cut down something that is natural and growing in order to integrate it. Because these things just happen in the unconscious, but in order to make it conscious, in order to integrate it, you at times have to cut it down. And this is why most of the whole individuation process is totally natural, in which you do as little as possible. You don't interfere, you let things take their course. There are also times when you have to consciously act and consciously do something, and then I had to cut them down. And you know, to me, the beauty is making a meditation mat, so one integrates this whole dynamic into one's spiritual life. And I was even shown a diagram of how the energy of these lilies is integrated. So in a way, the conflict which I was presented with brought something into consciousness, this very terrifying primal power of the feminine, which then, through the suffering, through it, these tigers, these extraordinary tigers suffering, that's what made me conscious of them, and then it could be integrated. And which I found very, very moving. And there's a lovely, one of my great, great plays is Hamlet. And of course it's one of the basic themes of Hamlet, is the transformation of the feminine. And he has it in his mother. I mean, most men encounter the dark side of the feminine through their mother, because it's much easier to project it onto your mother than onto your wife or girlfriend. And although you can do on that. And he actually confronts his mother with this darkness. And she says, "Thou turn'st mine eyes into my very soul, and there I see such black and grained spots as will not leave their tinct." And he'd also accused her of, you know, total overt sexuality and everything, all the darkness. I mean, there's this incredible line when he talks about, "In the rank sweat of an enseamed bed, stewed in corruption, honeying and making love over the nasty sty." You know, if that isn't the description of the, you know, one's mother, I mean, I didn't mean that personally. But you could see that, you know, this is the overwhelming aspect of the goddess, just procreative sexuality without any boundaries, and that particular image, the rank sweat of an enseamed bed, stewed in corruption, honeying and making love over the nasty sty, is all full of symbols that relate to the feminine. Which, you know, because honey is to do with the feminine. They used to have an ancient Hindu marriage ceremony where they'd actually daub the woman's genitals with honey before she was. And pigs, of course, are also the great, great emblem of procreation of the feminine. And so he begins like that, and then he confronts her with this darkness. But then this transformation happens, and it happens actually after he's seen Ophelia buried. And Ophelia was his idealized woman, my soul's idol. You know, this whole adolescent romantic fantasy of an idealized woman. And Ophelia wasn't up to carrying the darker side of the feminine for him, so she went mad. And going mad means you get taken back into the unconscious, and then she drowns herself, she goes back into the unconscious. And when she's been buried, which means when she's been reintegrated back, this idealized image, and he's gone a bit crazy at her gravestone, then his mother says the most extraordinary lines in the whole thing almost. the whole play, and she says, "This is mere madness, and thus a while the fit will work on him. Anon, as patient as the female dove, when that her golden couplets are disclosed, his silence will sit drooping. Anon, as patient as the female dove, when that her golden couplets are disclosed, his silence will sit drooping." And the female dove is the highest form of the feminine. It is the Holy Spirit in feminine form. And her golden couplets, which are the marriage of opposites, which has happened within him. And out of this madness, because he's been so mad the whole play, that most people have read Hamlet, know Hamlet. I mean, he's crazy so much of the play. He's talking so much and he's mad, you know, just like one can be at times. And one gets, because if you go into that feminine, if you go into the dark side of the feminine, it can be like entering madness. You get carried away with it. "When that her golden couplets are disclosed, his silence will sit drooping." And this is the highest form of the feminine, Sophia, wisdom. The wisdom of the feminine, therefore be as wise as serpents. And so in a way, this whole transformation of the feminine, although you begin by saying the feminine has this very, very dark side, what do you do about it? You know, it can be terribly destructive, it can destroy any relationship, it can make men petrified, nothing most... I mean, I was so relieved when I read this line of Jung when he said... this is something he said when he was 80. He said, "I am afraid of women because they are very powerful, strong, magical beings." And I thought, if he's 80 and he says that and he still allows himself to be afraid of women, then that's fine for me. So there is that aspect of the feminine which is, and somehow the man has to enter that madness, the terror, the fear, you know, which women, because they embody the feminine, carry. But for this transformation to happen, and then Sophia wisdom, which is intuition, which is the highest form of the feminine, then that can develop, that can come through. So maybe we have a little break for 15 minutes or something, and then I'll finish this and we can have questions and then we can have lunch. I've just been told very, very interestingly that apparently in flower remedy, tiger lilies, the scent from tiger lilies, what is it?
The essence, which means the flowers are placed in a bowl of water and then placed in the sun for 24 hours.
Yeah.
And there's a remedy that's made from that, which actually the healing quality of the flower is often opposite from the quality of the flower itself. So the remedy that's made from it is prescribed for overly masculine constitutions or women that are... or people that are not in touch with it.
So. Somebody wants his daddy. So if you want to sneak in through the other door at the back.
Yeah.
I mean, you can go out that way, but if you want to sneak in, then you can sneak in through that door there. So, anyway, what do you do when you've got a problem? Well, this is a dream somebody had. The dream showed the problem and showed the remedy, which is... The dream was, "I'm flying in the space of a large room with great ease and skill. An unknown woman is flying together with me." This is a man's dream. "There is a strong erotic feeling between us as we fly. Our bodies trace lines in space as we move through it. These lines add up to distinct and precise configurations that actually tell a story. Part of me is observing the whole situation and is reading the story in the lines. My inner emotional situation is being spelt out in detail. A complex problem involving my mother and sexuality is being described. I know that I have to note the dream down so I can discuss it in therapy. It's very useful, dreamers, you see. I walk away from the large room to find a notebook. I pass the figure of a man whom I know a little standing by a gate. He calls me and I go over to him, but I find he is not his usual hard, polished, brittle self. He has become soft, gentle, and helpful. He says that he has heard I am going through or about to go through an intense and dramatic experience. I ask him who has told him this, and he says Mrs. Tweedy has, and that she is close by through the gate. I follow him, and he leads me to a table in a courtyard behind which Mrs. Tweedy is sitting, together with another woman in the group. She is granting wishes to certain people. And as I approach the table, she says, "Is there anything you would like to ask?" I reply that I would very much like to resolve the situation outlined in the flying dream. I put my mind onto the problem and she is able to pick up the dream contents. On the table in front of Mrs. Tweedy is a round metal disc, coin-sized, placed in white powder. I have to put another but slightly larger disc on top of the first one. As soon as I do this, I go into a trance-like state. My head bends forward so its top is facing the teacher. A tube seems to open in the top of my head, leading down deep inside of me. A strong energy wave comes from the teacher down the tube and strikes deep within me. I can feel shifts occurring at certain emotional points inside me. I sob and gasp, and after some time come out of the trance state. That was the dream. It was quite a powerful dream. And after the dream, the dreamer had states of fear and nameless dread, and much sobbing, sadness and anxiety, and inconsolable grief and anxiety. And that went on. This is a dream, and it's also an experience. The first part is a dream. He's flying with his anima, the feminine part, himself through a room. And he's also witnessing it, he's also observing it. And he's seeing this pattern that he and his own feminine self trace through the air. And he sees how it relates to his relationship with his mother and sexuality, which is often, you know, the whole incestuous thing is often very deep in the unconscious. And he wants to try and do something about this. He's seen the problem. And he wants to try and do something about this. And he meets what can be termed as a shadow figure, this man. And what's very interesting is this man who used to be brittle and hard has now become soft. And it always reminds me of this line I had in a dream a long time ago, which was turned soft by a very hard system. Sufism turns people soft. In fact, my favorite description of what a Sufi is you're a Sufi when your heart is as soft and as warm as wool. So Sufism had turned the shadow figure from being brittle and hard into being soft and yielding and helpful. And in fact, it's the shadow figure that takes him to the teacher, which is quite an extraordinary statement in itself, because the shadow is immensely useful. I mean, I remember I had... For me, for about 10 years, my biggest problem was my relationship with my mother. Maybe even more than 10 years, 20 years, 30 years. And one day I had a dream in which my mother took me to the bottom of this spiral staircase. And I left her and walked up this spiral staircase. And at the top of the staircase, I met Guru Maharaj, Guruji's teacher. And he took me to a satsang, being together. And then later he showed me a film of himself. He showed me a film of himself as a young man flying a kite. And what I found very, very moving was that my relationship with my mother, the problems in that, had taken me to the bottom of this staircase, which then I walked up to meet Guru Maharaj. So what was for me an incredibly difficult psychological situation had taken me to meet the teacher. In this dream, the shadow takes him to meet Mrs. Tweedy. And She is granting wishes to certain people, which is, of course, very useful. And she says, is there anything you would like to ask? And this relates to something I discussed on Thursday, that the teacher gives you what you want, which to us on this level seems slightly incomprehensible, you know, because spirituality is shown as a struggle and everything is taken away from you, and the idea that the teacher is giving you what you want is slightly foreign in some ways. But that is totally correct. Somewhere, and it's not here and it's not on this level, but somewhere the teacher will give you what you want. But of course the great thing is, what do you want? You know? But at this moment the dreamer has this very disturbing, very powerful psychological problem, and he would like some help with it. And he tells her the dream, and she opens his head, and a lot of energy goes through and clears out the blocks. And actually his life has changed quite enormously since then. He had that dream about 3 months ago, and his whole life, his relationship with the feminine has been cleared out enormously. In fact, he's no longer dominated by the dark side of the feminine. And what this dream describes is the way help on the Sufi path comes from a higher source. It's, if you like, the psychological problem. In one way, you don't deal with on a psychological level. The psychological problem is used to make you cry out in total despair and ask somewhere, so the help can then be given. You don't try and become a balanced, sorted out human being. That is not the objective. I remember once a very famous Jungian analyst said to Mrs. Tweedy, she said, the mistake I've made is I always tried to be balanced and sorted out. And Mrs. Tweedy certainly never tried to do that. You know, if you read her book, you just see how crazy she went. So somewhere, the problem becomes so desperate that you cry out, and you cry out, and you cry out, and then help is always given. When you've reached that moment of total despair in which you no longer know what to do, when the ego can no longer deal with the situation, but you have to be pushed to that point where you can no longer cope yourself. And that's, in a way, the crux of the thing. Then you surrender. Then somewhere you ask for help. And then the help is always given. Because it has to be given. He has to help you. If you ask somewhere, the help has to come. Of course, it doesn't come in the way you think very often. And very often you don't even notice that it's come. Because sometimes the help can be given very, very deep within you or at a totally different level that seeps down into you. And you don't even know that it's given. But if you are sincere and you ask, the help is always there. You know, we are helped so, so much. And very often the less we know about it, the better. Because if we know about it, then we identify it and we think we have spiritual this and spiritual that. And part of the whole path of this, of the Naqshbandis that came from these Sufis in Nishapur, was that they realized that there's an enormous danger in identifying at all with spiritual experiences. And that the worst thing for the ego, the moment the ego thinks it's had a spiritual experience, it's even more and more difficult to get rid of it. You know, it's why we have no initiations, nothing. You know, when there was this wonderful comic thing with Mrs. Tweedy in India, and this person who always wanted to be initiated by Guruji said, you know, he'd had this initiation and they'd prepared this and food had been blessed and this wonderful initiation. And he said to Mrs. Tweedy, you must be initiated by Guruji too. And she went and she didn't think it was really quite right. And she asked Guruji and he said, no, if you want to become nothing, how can you be something? You know, if you're initiated, we have such a misunderstanding anyway of initiation in the West. And you get a new name, and you get this, and you get that. And God. Real initiation is just a widening of the horizon. and it happens on again and again and again. And you know, just like for the child when it leaves the house and goes to school, that is an initiation, and it happens. Well, it's just a widening of a horizon initiation, but. And so when you have a problem, a deep, deep problem, and then you ask, and somewhere the help is always there. Help is always given. And for the dreamer, this dreamer is actually quite dramatic. And somewhere energy came that just cleared him out, and so it just brought everything to the surface. And then the work, the effort, was to hold on, was to bear all the anguish, all the pain that came up in him. And because this energy that can come from a different level can be incredibly powerful, and if you're ready, I mean, you have to be ready to have it, and then the stuff, it isn't nice, you know, we have this whole misconception that spiritual life is the experiences of bliss and that's all. You know, it's not to say there aren't extraordinary experiences of bliss, but often, I mean, Kundalini can bring havoc with it. Energy can it brings up everything from the unconscious, all the rubbish you never dreamt you had. You know, it's like people come to Mrs. Tweedy, and often for years things just get worse and worse and worse and worse. And then those who are sincere stay. They stick through it. They hold on in spite of everything. And those who aren't sincere go off, and that's the way it should be. And so for this dreamer, everything, it brought up everything that had been hidden inside of him just came up, and he just had to hold on and experience it and suffer through it. And also the other thing he said was that when he told the dream, it was very, very helpful, because it actually made the whole experience more substantial. It made it more real. Just by sharing it in a group, it validated his own inner experience, which could seem very, very confusing. It became more real. It became more tangible. But so that's a different way of dealing with a psychological problem. Except that you could say he didn't do anything, he just had to suffer. But somewhere he'd aspired, or his attitude was right, that he could ask and it could be given. And it's like this whole myth, you know, finding a teacher, which, you know, the West is totally preoccupied in many, many people, that you go off and you've got to find a teacher, which is a total misconception. You never find a teacher, the teacher finds you. Through your aspiration, through your work upon yourself, you light a little light somewhere. And when the light is bright enough, the teacher will see it. And if you have karmas with that teacher, if you have a link with that teacher, the teacher will appear. It may seem you read a book, you have a dream, you meet somebody. It may seem like that on this level, but it's never, it's not right at all. You know, it's like Mrs. Tweedy didn't go to India to look for a teacher. She went to India to travel around a bit. And the last thing she expected when Lillian got this letter from Guruji, when she was staying with Lillian, that's Elle in the book, and you'll see that she's on the video we'll show later, and she got this letter from Guruji, in which Guruji said, "You have a Russian woman staying with you who has me in our heart of hearts." And Mrs. Tweedy said, "Oh, you know, Indian man, I have an Indian man in my heart of hearts." You know, I mean, she was, last thing she wanted, I mean, she was. So you don't, it's this whole paradox of doing and not doing. You make an enormous effort, yes, you have to make the ultimate effort, yes, but you don't do anything at all. And it's all given. And you just have to suffer through it. And I find it very interesting, because there are two sorts of people that come to the group in some ways. There are some people whose life has been so incredibly difficult, and who have such problems, that they come to the group and the group becomes like a cocoon. The group becomes very, very supportive, and it allows them to integrate and to resolve those problems, which is actually my situation. I mean, I came to Mrs. Tweedy in a total mess, psychologically, physically, everything. And she said, you know, you'll be all right in about 3 years, and it took about five before I could even hold a conversation with anybody, before I could even eat a proper meal. I was in such a physical, psychological mess. And for people like I was in that sense, in a way, it's The group is like a support, a cocoon. It helps you. It helps you heal yourself. It gives you a protective space. And then there are people who come who life hasn't touched, and then they get it hard. Then when they come, then the troubles really begin. And they get everything thrown in their face. And some people come and they get teased remorselessly and remorselessly and remorselessly. There was one man who came and he said he wasn't frightened of women. And I mean, my God, you know, within a month, Mr. Tweedy just had to look at him and he was out the room. You know, I mean, she made... I mean, it's lovely. There was one woman who came and she had this beautiful black hair which was dyed, but she didn't like the idea of anybody knowing it was dyed. And so the first time she came, Mr. Tweedy said, "What wonderful black hair you have." And she said, "Yes, comes in the family." And so every time this person came for months, Mrs. Tweedy commented in front of everybody about how wonderful her black hair was, how wonderful, you know, how great it was, and look at that person's black hair. And eventually, of course, the person came to Mr. Tweedy. It's not real, it's dyed. And of course, after that, Mrs. Tweedy never mentioned her hair ever again. So some people get totally exposed and get ridiculed and get laughed at. And then if they stay, then fine. And some people just never appear to get noticed at all, and they just sit in the corner for years and years, and that's right for them. And some people get an enormous amount of attention. You know, some people, Mrs. Tweedy will never even say hello to, and they'll come for 5 or 6 years and she'll hardly appear to notice them. And other people, because they have a different need, they'll have an enormous amount of personal attention. And then other people in the group get jealous. Why does this person? Because there's a need. Because they've been so wounded and nobody has ever paid them attention. So Mrs. Tweedy makes them the most special person. And that's what I find so extraordinary and so beautiful. And some people like that, they need just personal attention. They need to be made to feel the most important person. Because all through their life they've been despised and rejected and trampled on. And so that will happen. And so it's different for everybody. And people get what they need.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.